Beautiful. Welcome, everyone. Just to frame our shiur, the goal of this shiur is really to just go through the basics of preparing for Pesach in terms of the halachos involved, of kashering our home, and everything that needs to be done in anticipation of celebrating the Chag of Pesach. Next week, I think on Tuesday night, I believe, we'll have a shiur on the Haggadah. And that'll have more inspirational insights related to the Haggadah. So I always like to begin the halachos of preparing for Pesach by trying to give ourselves a context that I feel is very, very important. And that is that the Rambam writes in his introduction to Hilchos Chametz Umatzah that there are three mitzvahs aseh and five mitzvahs los aseh with respect to observing Pesach. The three mitzvahs aseh are tashbisu, which is the mitzvah to destroy our chametz, achilas matzah, the mitzvah to eat matzah, and of course, sipur yitzias mitzrayim, the obligation chayev adam liros etz atzmo, kilu hu yotzev mitzrayim. A person has to envision themselves as if they themselves are leaving mitzrayim. Then we have the lo saseis, not to eat chametz from a certain time on the 14th day of Pesach, not to eat chametz all 7 days of Pesach, not to eat mixtures of chametz, and two lavim, not to own chametz, bal yeroye u bal yematzeh. There is no prohibition, contrary to some popular belief, there is no prohibition to look at chametz. Bal yiroye does not mean you're not allowed to stare at chametz. It means you're not allowed, to, unless the chametz is somewhere where you shouldn't be staring altogether. And then that would be very weird, right? You're not allowed to see chametz that you own. It's an expression of ownership. You're not allowed to have chametz in your rishus. So you're not allowed to own chametz. So there's no prohibition to seeing chametz. Now, that doesn't mean you should walk down the street and make it a point of staring at chametz. We're trying to remove ourselves from the world of chametz. And it's very important to remember that as we prepare for Pesach and we focus to a large degree on the mitzvah of tashbisu, of eradicating chametz from our homes, which of course has an underlying hashkafic element, the notion of chametz sort of representing that inflated, ego-driven Yetzer Hara that we're trying to eradicate from our environment and return to the more simplistic, foundational building blocks of matzah, of water, of flour, without the inflation of the rising of the bread, of more, more contracted from a time perspective and focused type of approach, which is related to Cheirus in a number of different ways. So we relate to cleaning for Pesach. It's to get rid of all our chametz. But it's important to remember our priorities, because while our priorities are certainly to eradicate chametz halachically from our home, there are other things that we need to be preparing for Pesach. We need to prepare for Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We should all be purchasing a nice Haggadah and preparing some Divrei Torah, going to a shir, getting some nice Divrei Torah. I just sat, we had a little family meeting with the younger kids where we discussed all sorts of things we were going to do in the house to decorate for the Seder. We had a number of different experiential ideas of things to use walls and to use tables and to use, they want to use a fireplace or something. But then my wife came home and some of those ideas went away. But the point is that effort needs to be expended to really focus on making the Chag beautiful for ourselves, for our families. And that's where cleaning for Pesach becomes really relevant, because while certainly it should be a priority to do what we need to do and we have to do, there is a large gap often between what must be done and what people embrace in the context of preparing for Pesach as spring cleaning, as just making everything cleaner. So, for example, I walked into one of our bedrooms last Sunday. I was in my study preparing shurim and took a break, walked into one of the bedrooms, and the clothes were everywhere, and drawers were being cleaned out, and clothing was being put into bags for Yad Leah, and things were being, I don't know the right word, pruned, whatever it is. And I looked at this and I said, this is beautiful. My wife always knows. She says, don't worry, I know. It's not clean. We're not cleaning for Pesach. We're just cleaning, right? So you can do that. That's wonderful. Tavo aleihem bracha. I think cleaning is great. Some people I know clean a lot. But don't blame that on the halachas of preparing for Pesach. Don't enter your Seder feeling overwhelmed and exhausted because you chose the three worst weeks of the year to organize everything you own and everything your kids own and everything your husband owns. That's absurd. There's what's expected and required, and then there is sort of using this time, since you're cleaning anyway, to do more than that. It's not a bad thing to do more than that. I'm not saying it's not a nice thing that cleaning for Pesach also brings the home, the bias, to a certain place of nikios and a certain, you know, that does sparkle in the anticipation of Yontif. But we have to keep our priorities straight, and we don't want anybody, in particular our Nashim Tzidkaniyos, to come to the Seder literally not even being able to make it through Kiddush because they're so exhausted because they have spent the last 2.5 weeks, you know, 10 hours a day cleaning the house, so that, you know, which we're just going to basically trash for the next 7 days. It's a horrible time to clean, if you think about it, because everybody's then home for 10 days. So, like, whatever you cleaned is going to become dirty, just not with chametz, but with other dirt, right? With matzah, which is more dirt prone to get around the house than even bread. So it's important to make that distinction. And that's part of what we try to do tonight in our shir, which is give some direction what needs to be done and what, you know, so that we could have some priorities. Sometimes we become surprised that certain things that we think are very expected and absolutely need to happen don't need to happen at all. And other things that maybe we're a little less careful about actually are very, very important and really, really should happen. One of the examples I always give is, you know, you do not need to move your refrigerator or your stove. There does not need to be any moving of appliances to clean for Pesach unless you move appliances all year round while you're eating sandwiches and just dripping chametz everywhere. But checking the pockets of our clothing, which is sometimes something we don't get to, where we do go to Kiddushim or we go to, you know, things like that, and we're not always as careful, you know, in a pocket is where you could find real chametz, or in a suitcase is where you could find real chametz. I travel a lot, so I live on granola bars because they're light and they're filling and they're only 100 calories. And so always in cleaning for Pesach, granola bar, that's a good piece of chametz. That's a nice Bal Yeroya piece of chametz. That's not a Cheerio from 3.5 years ago that rolled off a bowl of cereal from a high chair onto the floor. It was already not Roy Lachilas anything when it probably went onto the high chair, and now it's like decomposing or whatever, and somebody found it on Pesach, and literally, like, all Gehenna breaks loose. You know, we've lost our chelik in Olam Haba. So, you know, there are different, but a granola bar in a suitcase, that's a real thing. So sometimes we become so obsessed with some of these details that we miss some of the more important cleanings for Pesach. Okay, so let's begin. So first of all, what is chametz? That's important to know. Chametz is the combining of the five grains, wheat, spelt, oats, barley, and rye, in contact with water for more than 18 minutes without manipulation. So in other words, the Shulchan Aruch writes, if you were to take flour and water and combine them together and knead them for 12 hours, you could make a matzah. That would not be chametz. It's only chametz if it's been left to sit, to rise, for a period of 18 minutes. Most matzah factories are making the matzah round in 18 minutes. I don't know if you've been to a matzah factory and watched, but there's a lady that stands at the front, and she screams at everybody, you know, that we got to hurry up, and there's a clock, and everybody's moving, and we make the matzah. So that's what becomes chametz. The first thing that happens, as we anticipate Pesach, is bedikas chametz, is we begin to search for chametz. Pre-cleaning for Pesach, believe it or not, is really all about preparing for bedikas chametz. That's the final exam, right? That night before, where we're going to search for chametz, where we put out a little chametz. We'll talk about that in a minute. But that's the night we search for chametz, and we want to prepare the home for that chametz. So how do we do that? So it used to be that when homes were simple, you know, when people had, like, you know, three rooms and not so much food in their house, and there weren't preservatives and everything, so food didn't even last that long, You know, on the night before Pesach, that's the way Chazal are envisioning this. They did not envision 3 weeks of an ammonia, you know, and teams of people from Sri Lanka, you know, like in your house helping you. Like that was not their vision. Their vision taka was that you prepare the home for Bedikas Chametz, you come home a little early, you search the home, you probably find a few things, and then you make Pesach. That was the original vision. So we've, Baruch Hashem, we've, you know, merchandised that out quite a bit and added our own very special contemporary anxiety to the whole thing. But that's really what we're aiming for. So what has to be clean for Pesach? Kol makom shenichnas bo chametz. Any place where we bring chametz. Those are the places that have to be clean for Pesach. So rooms that you know that you bring chametz into, or you think, if you have small children or animals, you think it's, or husbands, you think it's likely that chametz was brought into that room has to be checked, and therefore that room has to be cleaned for Pesach. Rooms that we don't bring chametz into, you don't have to even go into to prepare for Pesach. So if you have an attic and no one goes in there, you don't have to say to yourself, well, maybe there was an afternoon where someone was hungry and they were thinking and they went in there and they, no, done. Rooms that people don't use, rooms that people don't go into, rooms that are not functional, areas of rooms that are not functional, kol makom shemachnisim bo chametz. If you know for a fact, if everyone in your house is an adult, and no one puts food under the bed, you do not have to move the bed and start cleaning out all the things under the bed. What's under that bed is not food. It's not chametz. It's dirt. So that may be disgusting that you live that way, but it's not part of Hilchas Pesach. You do not, any place that you cannot, places you can't reach, right? Our refrigerator is pushed into the wall. It's surrounded by cabinetry, right? So you can't get to behind the refrigerator. So I don't have to assume that, well, maybe something went all the way under and all the way, no. Kol makom shemachnisim bo chametz. You take the broom, you sweep it a little bit under the fridge where you imagine things might have come through a little bit, and you're done. You don't have to move the appliance. You don't have to move your washing machine. You don't have to move your oven and start disconnecting it from the gas and all these other things. Only if you believe or you're concerned that chametz was actually brought there. How much of an outside chance? If there's a 2% chance, there's a 1% chance. It has to be a place that's normative to bring chametz. That's the chashash, and that's what we do. Okay, now. Even a place that's machnisim bo chametz, this is very important, we are not looking for microscopic crumbs. Okay, chametz, believe it or not, has a shear. And that shear is a kezias. It's not the kezias we're going to make you eat on the matzah. That'll be a much bigger kezias. But chametz has a shear. And the Mishnah Berurah writes, if you have chametz that's less than a shear, and it's already nifsal, it's already disgusting, then you don't need to eradicate that chametz. And that means that, again, the Cheerio that maybe on Sukkos got under the thing, that's a tiny little nothing, that is not edible, and that is absolutely disgusting, and may be under your fridge, is not part of the mitzvah of Tashbisu. You do not need to move your fridge to find that Cheerio, even if the Cheerio is there. Now, if for some reason there's a wonderful plated meal under your refrigerator, then you have other problems, but then you would have to move your refrigerator and make sure there's no chametz there. But chametz that is smaller, let's say, than an olive, and is nifsal, is just, it's disgusting, it's gross, you would not eat it, that is not substantial enough to be a problem of ownership on Pesach. Now, that doesn't mean you can take that piece of gross item and ingest it. I'm not suggesting you do that, but you don't have to get rid of it. Anyway, if there's any possible edibility to it at all, it'll be included in Mechiras Chametz. Even if it's not included in Mechiras Chametz, because maybe you didn't include it in the Mechira because you're Machshavit or whatever, it's included in Bittul Chametz. I mean, there are many safeguards here to make sure that things that are in your home, that you don't know. Now, we don't rely on those things for a juicy challah. We don't say that, you know, let there be a juicy challah sitting on the counter, but you're mevatel the chametz, that we'll get rid of. Or that we'll sell if we sell chametz gomer. But we don't, things have to be at least somewhat of substance. Bedikas chametz is done the night before Pesach. Pesach, I believe, this year is Friday night. Is that correct? So Thursday night, we'll do Bedikas Chametz. And Bedikas Chametz should be treated, even though, again, today, it's so ironic. But what's happened is we've become so effective at cleaning for Pesach. Now the Bedika has become somewhat of ritualized, that it's not even, you know, it's not even significant. And we all get together, we put out our 10 pieces of bread. There's a minhag, says the Ramah, to put out 10 pieces of bread. There are different reasons for that minhag. Some people believe it's Kabbalistic. Some people suggest that maybe we're worried that it's sort of a bracha levatala. If you know for sure there's no chametz anywhere, you're not going to find any chametz, this way we'll find something. Others believe that's absurd, because we have the brachas bir chametz. It's if you find chametz, it's not, you know, you don't have to manufacture a finding. But for all of us who do bedikas chametz, we usually do put them out. In our family, we put them out in plastic bags. We do not. There's no mitzvah to create crumbs around your house on Erev Pesach and to literally watch your wife have an aneurysm as she moves from room to room. Right? There's no mitzvah to do that. So we break up 10 pieces of bread, usually outside. We put each piece of bread in a plastic bag. We give each person a job. The only problem with the plastic bag is it kind of makes the feather person feel a little bit like a loser, because there's not much to do with the feather. But I told the kids that you're not really supposed to touch the chametz with your hand. You really need to put it with the feather onto the spoon and then into the bag. But that has started to, as my kids are now learning with real Talmidei Chacham, and one of them learned Maseches Pesachim, that I think I am slowly losing authority over. But that's what we do. If you're going to use actual bread and put it out, use bread that's not as crummy. Don't use, you know, use a white bread or use a pita or use something like that. But we put it out and we do Bedikas Chametz. If you're not going to be home on Erev Pesach, then you should do Bedika without a bracha. The bracha we make is not Al Bedikas Chametz, Al Bir Chametz. And you would do the Bedika the night before you leave, whenever that is. At night, that last night before you leave. So if you're leaving the morning Thursday morning, so you would do it Wednesday night, and you would take that chametz with you to burn on Erev Pesach wherever you are.
So you still do the 10 pieces of bread even if you're doing it.
You do the 10 pieces of bread, you collect them, and you bring that wherever you are, and you do the bir chametz. You don't do the bir chametz on Thursday, you do the bir chametz on Friday, when everyone else does the bir chametz, wherever you are. I always tell people that when you are packing your luggage, put the chametz somewhere that's easily accessible. If you're flying, put the chametz in a carry-on, not in a suitcase. The last thing you need is to discover that your suitcases went to Arizona when you're going to Florida, Nebuch, first world problems, right? And now you're sitting there and, you know, and delivered to your hotel room on the first day of Chol HaMoed is a suitcase, and you open it up and there's your 10 pieces of chametz. So you don't want that to happen. So you take it with you and you do the bir chametz, and then you say the kol chamira. We're also mafkir all our chametz. We relinquish ownership over it, and we do that the night of Bedikas Chametz, and then we do it again the night that we're going to leave. If you're leaving for Pesach, so you're not cleaning your home for Pesach, which we'll discuss in a second, then Bedikas Chametz is really a little bit of a manufactured ritual. You still do it, but and if you're there Thursday night, you do it with a bracha. What the minhag has become is to designate a specific room, which you exclude from the sale, which you allow to really be a makom baduk, and you clean that room. And I always tell people, don't choose the kitchen, right? Choose a very simple room. Choose a very easy room, and that's the room you'll check. And that's how it goes. All my life that I grew up, we did Bedikas Chametz, and then we had pizza bagels. That was just what we did, you know? So if you're going away for Pesach, and you're not going to the sales nachal till the next morning, and you have chametz in the house, that's what it is. So you put it out, you take it seriously, but obviously you're not going to start looking in every nook and cranny, because you're not really cleaned for Pesach. Yeah, sorry. Why would you do that? You would do that so that you could fulfill the takana of Bedikas Chametz in a more realistic way. In other words, you want to take an area. In other words, what we do when people go away for Pesach who don't want to clean is we don't just sell their chametz, we sell the home with all the chametz. We lease the home with all the chametz. So when you do that, so then you're not going to own this area anyway over Pesach. As opposed to releasing one area, which will be yours over Pesach, but will be a makom baduk. It'll be the place that you do your bedikas chametz, and therefore it has its own sort of status in that regard. Yeah. It was done at night because even though there's very little light at night, a candle, the assumption is that in those homes, a candle had greater illuminative capacity in the dark at night than it does during the day. So if you think about it, if you were to take a candle now, and that's why the takana was made at night, because you would be bokim l'or aner, and then you could really see everything that's going on. Today, Bizman Hazeh, most poskim say, some poskim say you should use a flashlight, that the candle is ridiculous. Now we have things that are much more effective than a candle. Some poskim say, in our family, we also use a flashlight. We use the candle because it comes in the kit from the Telz Yeshiva. So you use the candle. It's like we use the feather. But we also give a flashlight to everyone. Our minhag is to not have batteries available that night also. You see, we have no stress in our house, Erev Pesach. You could feel that's a purely balabatish thing. Rabbanim, everything's smooth. Everybody's inspired. Everybody's walking around, mamish, like, Ovdei Hashem. Yeah.
The 10 pieces of bread.
Yeah. In theory, anything that's chametz, but the Shulchan Aruch does talk about bread specifically. I think it's, it should be real chametz,
Well, if it's crackers or Cheerios.
I think the minhag is to use bread. I think the minhag is to use bread.
Period,
you save a little challah. You save a little pickle. You don't change anything you do, Dr. Singer. Do me a favor. Don't. You are way. Your Pesach. I'm not playing around with your Pesach. I don't even know what you're doing here. All right. And we do the bedika. What happens? Every once in a while, we do find chametz on Chol HaMoed. If that happens, then we burn the chametz. We do it without a bracha. And that's it. Or a fatan yantif, whatever. Flush down the toilet and get rid of it. And that's it. You make the bracha. There's no Shechayanu. The minhag is not to talk about things that are not related to the bedika. So you're allowed to say, we skipped the room. You're allowed to say, did we get everything? You're allowed to say, don't light your sister on fire. All those things are mutter to say while you're doing bedikas chametz. But you're not supposed to talk about things that are unrelated to the bedika. Then we do bitul chametz, as I said, and then we have bir chametz. Bir chametz, should be careful not to do, we have in the community, we have a bir chametz that's run by the fire department. It's not great to do on your own bir chametz, unless you really know what you're doing. I remember Richie Starshevsky used to do his own bir chametz, but his son's a firefighter, so he had personal hashgacha on many levels. But most of us will go, and you'll throw the bread into the thing that's burning, and the chametz will be burnt. What about garbage? So that sometimes comes up, depending on what day is garbage and those kinds of things. So I just tell people, so first of all, they have a bin at the park for garbage. If you want, you can, that's what we do. Our last two garbages goes usually in my car, and that's the minig in our home. And I drive it to the thing, and this is like the ultimate taking out the garbage. You don't just take it out to your house, you take it out, mamish, all the way to the park, and they have bins, and you throw the bins in, and you throw out the garbage. By the way, one of the challenges with the plastic bags of bedikas chametz is that they will not let you put plastic into the fire. So what happens is we wait until we get there so that this process does not happen anywhere near our house, and then we individually empty each plastic bag of bread into a larger brown paper bag, and then throw the plastic bags out, and then throw the thing in the fire. But we do not do that in our home. Yeah.
You just use a piece of paper towel and put tape on it.
There we go. Very good. Very good. Paper towels and tape. Okay. Beer chametz. Now, it's very important that the... Now, so what do you do if you do have leftover garbage and you're not schlepping it to the thing? So it should just be off your property. You should not be in your garbage can on your property. It really shouldn't be even in your garbage can off your property. It really, for this one time, don't tell anyone, if you had to, if you mamish got stuck, just leave the garbage at your curb in a bag, and they'll pick it up, and it'll be the end of it. That's your worst case scenario. It's better. It's a little bit better. Better not to do that. But once it's off your property, you really don't have to. It's not your. It's not your problem. We have mechiras chametz. Yeah.
Just to clarify this whole thing. So the real requirement is that you not own the chametz, right?
Yes.
So once you mevatel it, you're not over a quarter of it. You're just afraid that you might eat it if you see it.
Correct.
So that's why you have to get rid of it.
Correct.
Well, that's why you don't have to clean under the fridge, because you're never going to get to it.
Because you're never going to get to it. Correct.
So all of this stuff is really our focus, right, basically? I'm not minimizing it, but it's not like...
Well, no, it's also part of the mitzvah of tashbisu. It's also part of the mitzvah of destroying chametz in anticipation of Pesach.
It's yours. It's not yours anymore.
Well, if it's not yours and you've been mevatel it, so then you've been mesalik yourself from it. But part of the preparation for Pesach is, on some level, to destroy it. You should not... You say the final bittul only after the beer, because you want to be mevayer your chametz. That's the mitzvah of tashbisu, but you're correct. If I never had chametz in my house because, you know, they're gluten-free and silly, you know, all these things, I've been fielding a lot of these things this year for some reason... so then there's no mitzvah to start eating chametz so that you can get rid of it on paper. You know, you're right. So these are, I mean, that discussion of why we do bidika and why we do bittul and why we do mechira, that's a little more complicated than I'm answering now. It's a big machlokes between Rashi and the Ran, big machlokes Rishonim, but we'll leave it at that. Mechira's chametz involves the following. So one of the things we do is, let's say we want chametz around for after Pesach. So the rabbi sells the chametz on our behalf. You do not sell your chametz to the rabbi. I don't want to own any of your chametz. I don't want to own anything that you own, right? You give me a document, and that document empowers me to go ahead and sell your chametz to the non-Jew on your behalf. The way that sale basically works is we evaluate the chametz. That's why we ask you to put a basic evaluation of how much you think it's worth, so that the sale has some, you know, teeth to it. We ask you to fill out where the chametz is. That doesn't mean I get these calls all day on Erev Pesach. I forgot to put on the form that there's also chametz in the laundry detergent room. I forgot to put on the form that in the garage there's chametz. That chametz is all sold. The only purpose of designated where it is so that if the non-Jew, to substantiate the sale, that if the non-Jew were to show up at your house and he owns things he could never find, and he has no idea where they are, so that kind of undermines, on some level, the veracity of the sale in terms of its seriousness, not in terms of its effectiveness. It's still a perfectly good sale, and they still own all that chametz, but we do try to clarify where it all is. And the way it works is we do 7 different kinyanim, and basically, the non-Jew gives us a down payment of a certain amount of money and silver coins and other types of kinyanim. With that down payment, they own all of the chametz. The same way when you buy a house, you make a down payment and you completely own that house. You don't own that percentage of the house. You own the whole house and you owe, God bless us, a mortgage, right? But if something happens to that house, it's not the bank that loses the house. It's you who loses the house. It's your house. That's the way it works with the guy. It's the exact same thing. He gives us a certain amount of money, and we transfer all of the chametz to him. And we do that through various kinyanim. You're welcome to come see it if you want. And we also arrange so that it takes place during different times for people that are in different time zones. That's why we ask you what time zone you're going to be in, because we have to make sure, both earlier and later, that you don't own your chametz too early or too late. And basically, we sell the chametz to the non-Jew, and the non-Jew owns the chametz. The non-Jew is perfectly, he is the owner. A lot of people always, you know, get very nervous. Well, you know, what happens if the non-Jew doesn't want to sell back the chametz, then I'm going to lose all my chametz. And that's not a concern at all, because if the non-Jew wants to, if what happens is we meet with him after Pesach, and we say, look, you owe us however much money the rest of the chametz is worth. And we have an estimate of that, but part of the contract is that if you really wanted to complete this sale, there would be a panel of experts to come evaluate all the chametz. But let's just talk about David Adler's amazing, unbelievable liquor collection, right? So he's sitting there with like $20,000 of scotch, and the guy has only paid like a dollar as a down payment, but he owns all of the scotch. So if he wants to come into David's house and take one of his bottles of scotch, he's absolutely allowed to do that. But that shouldn't bother David, because after Pesach, or even then, he has to pay for it. He has to pay him the value of the bottle. This isn't a fiction. This is, he would owe him the money. He paid a down payment, but now he'd own the rest of the money. So, you know, that's basically the way it works. Okay, let's talk for a few minutes about what really is considered chametz. So obviously we're cleaning for pay. Yeah, sorry, what?
The chametz is owned by the guy. So I find chametz on Pesach. He said I should burn it and throw it in the garbage. So aren't I stealing the guy's chametz?
Yeah, so that's a big discussion. It depends a little bit. What you're finding. If something comes into your possession versus something that's, in other words, if you find chametz that you did not know existed at the time of this sale, so then that has to be disposed of. That clearly was not part of your das. That's different than, I know I have chametz, I said it was in the bathroom when really it's in the dining room. But if you come into contact with chametz that you had no idea was part of your whatever, then you're going to burn that chametz. But it is a good point. Very often, I get this shaila every year. I have someone who's not religious in my office, and I've made such a beautiful relationship with them, and I'm part of Project Inspire, and I'm, you know, working on them to send their kids to yeshiva and pay $150,000 a year in tuition and be so inspired. And, you know, I'm so into it, and they're so into it. Why don't I give them a form? So if it's a rabbi's form. It's so easy, and I'll help them sell their chametz and avoid all these surim of bal yeraya, bal yematzei. And I always tell people, you have to be very, very careful with that, because geneva is also an iser d'oraisa, right? You can't having them sell all their chametz to the guy and then eat the chametz is also that's gazela. You're not allowed to do that. Not allowed to steal. So that's also, you have to keep in mind that there's, you know, that's, it's a real thing. So you can't do it. The one thing that does come up, if you're going away for Pesach, we basically sell your house, so you really should not be in that house. It's not your house, and that's not normal for you to be in someone else's house. If I went home now and I found you in my house, so that would be normal, because a lot of people come to my house. But if you found me in your house, you would think that's very non-normal, right? So if a non-Jew comes to his house, which is used to be your house, and you're in there, that's weird. It's not, you're not supposed to be in someone else's house. So that's the truth. You're not supposed to. But we make a stipulation when we sell that people should be permitted to come in and out if they need something. So this always comes up, this shaila. You know, I sold the house. I didn't clean for Pesach, but I forgot swimming trunks. I forgot, you know, the car seat. I forgot, can I go into the house? When you sell your chametz, you have to give the guy access to the house. When I first came to the shul, I used to collect everyone's keys to their homes, to their cars. So I still have all of those keys. So I stopped doing that. And I have like those $50 van keys. I have no idea who goes to which key. I didn't think to write that down. I figured people would come back for their keys and they'd figure it out. So I switched the system, and now on the form, if you're going away for Pesach, it says, my keys can be found at this location. And you leave your keys at a neighbor's or somewhere that you are comfortable, or you already have keys. Sometimes you even end up taking them with you, okay? And as long as you're going somewhere normal, reachable, let's say you're going to Brooklyn. Or let's say you're not going somewhere normal. Let's say you're going to Brooklyn. So, all right, so the guy could go to Brooklyn, you know what I mean? You can't fly to Australia and expect, that's not reasonable, but... But you give them access. They need access to the car if you're not cleaning the car for Pesach and it has chametz and you're selling the car, or they need access to the house. Why was I bringing that up? Oh, so if you're going to come in and out, you could come in and out a little bit. If you're going to come in and out, though, you should really try hard not to sleep there. It's not appropriate to sell the house and then to sleep in the house. Every once in a while, it'll come up. You know, one time there was a young couple, they went away for Pesach, and then they literally had nowhere to be, you know, and it was, do they have to get a hotel room, or, you know, or something like that, or can they, you know, so I called up the guy, and I said, you know, can you give Rashut, you know, I mean, like, there are ways to deal with it, but for the most part, it's not your house, you shouldn't be in that house, but you can go in and out if you need something, if you want to get something. But that's really, now what also comes out a lot, this comes up all the time, is people, especially in Passaic, this comes up, because there are no hotels here. I'm going away for Pesach, I don't want to clean, but someone wants to use my house. That's not an option. That's just not an option. That's not a chesed. Don't offer that chesed, unless you really mean it. You could, and I've done this with people, you could sell rooms in the house, or designate rooms in the house where you're not going to, and then quarter them off, but you have to have access to bathrooms, you know, and then it starts, you know, well, can they go into the kitchen if they just want to use the water dispenser? Well, how are they not going to be able to go in the kitchen? They need to be able to use the refrigerator. Well, they're going to go in the, you know, like, it's not a simple thing. Don't be so quick to offer your house for Pesach unless you have a plan of how to get that done. Now, it could be that in that scenario, you do a very minimal cleaning for Pesach. You do a basic, very, very basic cleaning, and then you tell these people, don't move anything. Don't go, you know, looking into the closets behind games and this kind of stuff, because I did a basic cleaning, I sold the chametz, I was mevatel the chametz, I'm leaving, but, you know, and the basic things I cleaned, but don't deal with it. Anything that's chametz is also should be put away, and it should be not so accessible, but you are allowed to look at it, right? Every year somebody asks me about the curio cabinets. I have my chametz stick plates in the curio cabinets. Do I have to cover the curio cabinets? I've seen that done now in a lot of Bate Ovel. I think because some curio cabinets have a mirror in the back, so people cover them. So now I've seen that people assume that for some reason, like China has to be hidden during Avelos. It's like a new din. So you don't have to cover it, just make it not so accessible so you don't make a mistake and end up taking it out for some reason. What is chametz? Let's just talk for a few minutes. What is chametz? So any food that is nifsal me'achilas adam is still prohibited on Pesach. Normally for kashrus, if a food is not edible by a human being, not considered edible by a human being, it is not a problem of kashrus. On Pesach, even if something is nifsal me'achilas adam, it's still a problem for Pesach. Food that's nifsal me'achilas kelev, if it's not even edible by a dog, then it is permitted for Pesach. The Rush talks about, well, what if you take food that's not objectively edible by a dog in the sense that it isn't food, and you eat it anyway? So that's called achshavei. And achshavei means you take something that's inedible, and by eating it, you render its status edible, simply through the power of your actions. You've made it edible. You've said it's edible. So the question is, what happens with achshavei? So in general, that is considered a challenge. That is considered a problem, unless it's done shelo kederech achila. Where does this come up? This comes up with medications, right? So if you have a pill is not food, right? No one should eat a pill for a meal, right? If you're really, really, really hungry, you don't take a pill, right? So no one should eat a pill for a meal. A pill is not food, but if you put it on your tongue and you swallow it, how could you say it's not food? That's achshavei. That's eating. So that's only true if you eat it kederech achila. You eat it like you would eat food. Nobody swallows food whole, right? That's not how we eat, right? You chew food, you eat food, to put something on the edge of your tongue and just swallow it. So that's shelo kederech achila. Something that's eaten shelo kederech achila, that's nifsal ma'achilas kelev. It's not right for a dog either. And you eat it shelo kederech achila, so that's considered fine. And that's why all pill medications are kosher for Pesach. You don't need to call me. You don't need to look it up on a list. You don't need to call up a manufacturer. You don't need to call your friend, the B'nai Brak. All pills that could be swallowed for any reason that is medicinal are considered kosher LePesach. It is true there are lists of pills that have chametz and don't have chametz. It is true that there are those that are machmir, and there have been over time, over Jewish history, those that have been machmir on pills that have chametz. It is now pretty much the position of all mainstream poskim and all of the major kashrus agencies and all of the internet sites making everybody crazy for Pesach, that swallowable pills are not a problem. What about a chewable pill? So that is a problem, because a chewable pill is derech achila. You eat the pill. There's even a little Fred Flintstone on the cover, making you feel really good about eating the pill. Like, this is, he likes this pill. Now you're going to like this pill. He eats the pill, right? So if you chew it and it has taste, that really does have to be kosher l'Pesach. That should not be done if it's not kosher l'Pesach. And then pills that are coated with some sort of flavoring, so that also sometimes people will be a little bit machmir on if you could really taste it. And there, if you could find a substitute, it's much better. Certainly, if you're dealing with any condition that is a sakana, then even if it's chewable or whatever it is, it's still something that needs to be done and should be done. If you have a pill and it's coated and that's the only way, so then there are other solutions to that problem. There's a possibility of wrapping it in something. There's a possibility of different things, but that's basically it. Liquid medications, also, if it's a cholish ein bo sakana, so that also does need to be, that also does need attention. You should try to get a kosher l'Pesach version. Sometimes the liquids are kidneys. So if they're kidneys and you're dealing with the real chole, it is possible that if you're dealing with the chole, that kidneys would be mutter. You're allowed to own kidneys on Pesach. It's not a problem at all. So if you're dealing with kidneys, then you should keep it separate from everything else, as we do with baby formula. Many baby formulas are kidneys, and you wash them in the sink, and you do it with cold water, and you keep it away from the table. But that would be mutter. Vitamins. So there is a little bit of a minig to be a little more machmir with the vitamins, and I would distinguish it in this way. Vitamins are sometimes taken for nutritional reasons and sometimes taken for medicinal reasons. If a vitamin is taken because there is a nutritional deficiency that manifests itself as some sort of medical condition, and by balancing that nutritional deficiency, you are solving that medical problem, then, you know, vitamins that are taken for heart issues, vitamins that are taken for, you know, then those things, if there is no Pesach alternative that's effective, then those vitamins could be taken. But if the vitamins are being taken simply because, you know, you walked into the vitamin shop and you see on this container that there's this guy and he's mamish, he's got like muscles, he's got the veins over the muscles, and he looks unbelievable, and you say to yourself, I want to look like that guy, and you know that if you take these vitamins, eventually you will look like this guy. And so, because that's how he got to look like that, he took all these vitamins, and that's why he has all these muscles. So those vitamins, we would stop for Pesach. It's a health issue, and you don't realize, Rabbi, how serious vitamins are, and you can't, blah, 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 you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, if the vitamins are simply a nutritional supplement, that you would not, you know, worry about it all. Then sometimes there's gray areas, and this relates to anxiety. You know, women who are pregnant or trying to get pregnant, you know, want to take prenatal vitamins, and they insist that the kosher l'Pesach ones aren't as good because all of the children that have been born from women who are pregnant during Pesach who took the free to prenatal vitamins are clearly not performing as well on their tests as the children in the classroom who did take the free to prenatal vitamins. And since we know this, and we know that obviously the you know, it's a problem. So again, you know, very often I will just be like, listen, you know, at a certain point, if you're that emotional about it, so maybe that's a factor, you know, and it needs to be medicinal. But in general, a multivitamin, you know, a little extra calcium, a little extra zinc, you know, things that people take just to bolster their health, you know. But if anybody's in any sort of treatment or something like that, where the vitamins are necessary because there's real nutritional deficiency, and they're core to their health, they should be taken. Yes.
Is the issue about kosher l'Pesach for vitamins, is that the same as the issue about whether it needs hashgacha during the year?
Yes. Yeah. And again, it has to do with, can you get a substitute that's, I'm not an expert. I've heard many different things. Some people have told me that the kosher vitamins are absolutely without a question the exact same thing as everything else being offered. And I'm telling you, you will talk to people and they will tell you, they are 100% sure that They felt one way with, you know, nature, valley, whatever, and they felt another way with, you know, I don't know, you know, like Schwartz's, right, you know, vitamin C. So that's the story. Creams, ointments, powder in solid form, all of these things can be used on Pesach, even if they contain grain alcohol. Just don't eat them, right? You should not eat these things, having nothing to do with chametz, having to do with just living through Pesach, right? So, but anything that that's not food, it's not roi l'achilas kelev, there's nothing to talk about. The only thing that we are machmir on are perfumes. And the assumption is that, I guess there is literature, that perfumes with alcohol is something that an alcoholic or somebody that's in desperate need for alcohol will consume. And so therefore, that is, I guess, common enough to create that concern. And therefore, perfumes should be considered drinkable. And therefore, we should make sure that they are kosher l'Pesach. But nail polish remover, hand lotion, baby shampoo, shoe polish, air freshener, all these things, you know. Now, mouthwash and toothpaste, interestingly enough, which everyone assumes is obviously a problem because you put it in your mouth, that's also not really food, right? We also shouldn't be drinking that or eating that. But many people are machmir, just like with makeup. Makeup doesn't need to be kosher l'Pesach either. But many people will be machmir to get a new lipstick or to make sure the lipstick is okay or on the list because it's right near your mouth and it's close to your mouth and maybe you will eat it if you, I don't know what women do. Maybe if they're really, really hungry, they eat their lipstick. I don't know how it goes. But I don't know how to type it for that. But that's a stope. Stope does not have to be kosher l'Pesach either. People are machmir with the dish soap. Okay. It's not, during the year, I wouldn't be machmir on that at all. But I know that some people feel just because it's touching your things that it's a problem. But really, hand soap does not have to be kosher l'Pesach. Again, do not eat it. Yeah.
Creams that have oatmeal?
Yeah, so that comes up every year. So creams that have oatmeal, so if the oatmeal is discernible and you can really see it, then it's really, so then... Some people are more machmir on that, I guess. But if it's pulverized as a base of the cream and really is does not make the cream edible in any way, shape, or form, you know what I mean. But if the cream is made in a way that it,
Aveeno is one of the potential problems because the grain is there.
It's what?
The grain is there.
You see the grain.
Yeah. The grain is there because that's what gives it the
potency.
Crop. And the same thing with Yardley oatmeal soap.
Yardley
makes a bar soap
right.
That has oatmeal.
In it.
I don't see the pieces of oatmeal.
Maple and brown sugar soap. Okay, listen, I think it depends. I guess it depends on the person. Okay, very quickly. Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, yes.
If we have, which we do, an office that we are responsible for.
Good.
And a non-Jewish worker who keeps her sodas and her chips and her things there.
Right. So, do you own the office?
We rent the office.
You rent the office. You're the renter and you're of that space. So, first of all, that office requires bedikah. I mean, you should do a bedikas chametz in that office. You should clean it for Pesach. The non-Jewish person should be given an area and told that their stuff cannot leave. First of all, if they could accommodate and not have the stuff. Great. It's theirs. There just has to be a plan of how to deal with it and dispose of it. And, you know, it's not usher for them to eat food on their own that they own in your space. You don't take ownership of it in any way. But it has to be clear who owns it. And it has to be clear, you know what the story is. The bigger shilas that happen with the offices is when people have shared food. Like people sometimes, like in an office, everybody will chip in and they get pretzels. And now what are we doing with the pretzels? And do I own part of the pretzels? Can I really sell the guy my chilek and the pretzels? Not really, you know. What do we do if one of the people are Jewish and the pretzels were owned by them over Pesach? Now you can't eat the pretzels after Pesach because it's chametz shavu l'av haPesach. So those are some of the questions that come up in the offices.
Yeah.
If it's your, if you, if no, the last time you're there, the last time you're there. Last time you're there? I mean, before Erev Pesach, without a bracha, and you do it. If it's yours, if it's your we're talking about you own the office. Not like you have a
cubicle.
Right, like you have a cubicle in somebody else's company. If it's your property.
With a bracha or without?
Without a bracha. But if it's your property, then it does need bedika.
But do you have to be there at night with the feather?
No. The last time you're there. The last time you're there. You do the bedika.
So let's say I'm going to be there in Erev Pesach. Should
right.
Should I make it my business to be there at night, the night before?
Will you be there early enough, Erev Pesach? You could just, it's your, you own the office?
I rent it.
You rent it, and it's, so it's your,
it's my rishus.
It's your rishus. So, if it's accessible, then you can do that. But I wouldn't make myself crazy. I think you can, the day before, look around and make sure that it's,
You still need 10 pieces of bread?
No. Not in an office. I do bedika here in the shul. I do not put out 10 pieces of bread. I do go through every shtender. And find lots of interesting things. Absolutely. Oh, I can tell you, you have no idea. The things that are happening during my drasha is quite tantalizing. Yes?
What about like dry cat food?
Pet food, in general, usually does have a problem with chametz. You have to get it. There's Starkey has a great list of what pet foods are okay. And you got to get a hold of that. Dog food. And pet food, well, keep it because it's Roy Lachilas Kelev. It's the greatest example of Roy Lachilas Kelev. So that's why it's more of a problem on Pesach. The fish food is a problem on Pesach. So we do run into problems sometimes where animals require chametz, and you can't get an alternative. And when that happens, there are potential solutions. You sell the animal to the guy, and you just stick something in the cage and hope for the best. In our family, we're davening. We got two goldfish at the beginning of Adar Aleph and Adar Beis. Adar Aleph is Olav HaShalom, but Adar Beis is still around. And we're really, really hoping that Adar Beis will also meet his Kel Male, but if he doesn't, fish food is a problem for Pesach. And it is Roy Lachilas Behema. So you get the worms. So they're already, the kids are already talking about, none of them are interested in touching those worms.
It's, just dry little things.
They say worms on them. And so they're, so I know exactly who's going to be feeding the fish. And so anyway, we'll see what happens. I'll keep you posted. But you never know what gets spilled over.
Yeah. An automatic fish feeder. Uh-huh. Literally, that it you plug it in.
And it just.
Right. It scoops up a certain amount.
Right, and feeds the fish.
Water.
That sounds like 24
hours. And when we had aquarius.
Right.
We used to use those when we went away. So you do the same thing with your little wormy.
Okay, I will let them know. If you do that, then I will do that. So I will let them know. All right, we don't have so much time left, and I want to get to kashering. Yeah, you don't have fish. Yeah. We had hamsters, but whatever. One of them, I think we had Teddy and Freddy, and I think one of them escaped. And we actually don't know where he is.
He's under your fridge.
He's missing. He's missing. Probably under our fridge, yeah. We should clean the fridge. And one of them, we don't have a great track record with animals. We Baruch Hashem, we keep the people around. Okay, so let's talk about kashering for a few minutes. To kasher for Pesach, we follow the following principle. Kibolo kach polto. The way the substance was absorbed, the way the chametz was absorbed, that is how it must be expelled. And so therefore, the medium through which the chametz got absorbed into the kli, into the vessel, that is the corresponding medium that is required to extract it from the vessel. And there are basically four different ways to kasher something. One is called libun. Libun means you incinerate the blios, the absorbed taste. One is called hagala, where you purge it. That's through boiling, through the medium of water. Irui roschin, where you pour something hot over it, and milui v'irui, which Ashkenazim don't really use, but it is available in extenuating circumstances, which has to do with soaking. So before we get into the specifics, so if you have something that absorbed chametz through fire, it needs to be kashered through fire. If you had something that absorbed chametz through the medium of water, right, or a liquid medium, or not directly through fire, then it has to be kashered through boiling, through hagala. And the same thing with all of these different pieces. There are two types of libun. One is called libun gomer, where you heat the metal till it glows, and the other is called libun kal, where you heat it to a very, very high heat. So let's talk about this for a second. China, pottery, earthenware, enamel, all these kinds of things cannot be kashered for Pesach. They absorb through the medium of heat, and the assumption in Hilchas Kashrus is that they cannot be brought up to the proper point of heat without risking their destruction, and therefore you are not going to be careful and cautious to bring them to the heat they need to be brought to, and therefore those things cannot be kashered. They need to be put away for Pesach. Glass. Sorry, what?
If they were left in base Kodesh.
So that is a big discussion. There's a tshuva from Rav Moshe. And my suggestion with that is, in general, we try not to rely. There's a concept that in 12 months, blios just disintegrate. So if there isn't an extenuating circumstance, we don't rely on that in general. If it's like there's a really, really pressing issue, I will tell you, in our family, when my father was becoming frum, and my grandmother kashered the home for him, because he stopped eating at their house. So there was one set of china that was a family heirloom that he told her she had to get rid of. And she said, if you're going to make me get rid of this china, forget it, I'm not kashering the house. And his Rebbe, Rabbi Fulda, brought the shiloh to Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe Feinstein told him that he should tell my father, to tell my grandmother, that she should put the dishes away for a year, and then she could use them. So I don't think that's considered like, you know, oh, we have a chasan and kawa, and they're getting married, and we have these dishes that we don't really know, and then they're from, and da-da-da. But we, you know, and so anyway, there are other ways to, we have family heirloom dishes that we don't know exactly where they were and where they weren't, but we want them to be part of our home, and we have a minig on Rosh Hashanah, of all days, to use it for the new fruit. So it sits on our table in a very bekavedic, appropriate time, with something very cold, at a time where nothing else hot is around, and it's part of our family, and it's something that's become a real ritual, and we connect to it, and we feel beautiful about it, but we circumvent the kashrus problem with it. Glass, really for Ashkenazim, cannot be kashered for Pesach. In extenuating circumstances where finances are a real issue, or again, there's a real issue, there's something called milui ve'iroi, where you basically soak the glass in water that you have to change every 24 hours over the course of 3 days, and that kashers glass. Plastic, for a long time we told everyone, can't kasher plastic for Pesach. The kashers agencies, I don't know if plastics themselves have kind of evolved a little bit, but they have become increasingly more makel on this. To the point that they basically say, don't go taking all your plastic to koshering, but if you have a thing here or a thing there that you really, really need, and you just it's too much money to buy a new one, or can't get a new one, or apparently one of the big examples is the Keurig, right? You know, and you really, really, you know, so koshering plastic, they've started to lighten up a little bit. And many of the kosher agencies are more makel now than they used to be on the koshering of plastic. So again, if it's a specific question, I encourage you to bring it forward. Yeah.
Teflon
or
plastic?
No, Teflon is a coating of metal. It's usually on a metal.
Yeah. Silicone?
I don't know. I might have to look that up. That's a good question. Flatware, when you're talking about all of your dishes and all of your silverware, not your dishes, but your silverware, your knives, your forks, all these kinds of things. So because those were not used through the medium of fire themselves, and they were used only outside of fire, but with hot food, so those require hagala. Hagala means you take a big pot. The minig is to kasher the pot. But really, as long as the pot hasn't been used for 24 hours, it does not need to be kosher l'Pesach. If you're in a pressing situation, you fill the pot with water, with boiling water, and then you immerse the kelim into the pot. You have to make sure that the kelim become completely immersed, but they don't need to be immersed at one singular moment. Unlike tevila, where we make sure to put the fork into the mikvah and we like let go for a second or whatever we do, or we shake it around so that it can be surrounded completely with water all at one time. When it comes to Hilchas Hagalah, you can do it in segments. So you could take the fork, you could put in one end, you could flip it over, be very careful not to get burnt, and then you could put in another end. And that will essentially kosher them with Hagalah. You could put multiple pieces in at once, as long as you're sure that they can all be magil without interfering with each other. And then the minig is to also, once you're finished, run them under cold water right afterwards, and that is part of the koshering process. The pot itself, first of all, in general, we have a halacha that when something is fleishig, it has to stay fleishig. When something is milchig, it has to stay milchig. We don't kosher from fleishigs to milchigs, and that's because Chazal didn't want us to have one set of dishes that we were just koshering back and forth. That would cause tremendous confusion. I can't imagine they ever dreamed how that would ultimately manifest itself in our kitchens, where we practically have two completely separate kitchens. We practically have two wives, one for milchigs and one for fleishigs. Like, we basically have no, you know, the amount of division is unbelievable. But the bonus for Pesach is that if you're koshering something for Pesach, you then do have the option to reallocate it towards fleishigs or towards milchigs, and that would be completely fine. When it comes to pots and pans, so again, it depends if it is the type of pot that was used through the medium of water in absorbing or a liquid, or if it was the type of pot that was used where the food was directly on the pot with no medium of liquid. It requires libun if there was no liquid there. If there was liquid, then it could be done with the pot. What about the pot itself? What if you have to kosher the pot itself? So the pot itself could be koshered simply by filling it with water and boiling up the water. However, the rim of the pot, in order to kosher the rim, you need the pot to overflow the water a little bit. So there are two ways to do that. One way is to just turn the heat very high and allow the water to boil over. The other way is to take a very hot object and put it in the pot, displacing some of the water, and then it will just flow over. The first time in my life I ever did this was in Big Bear, California. I was the head counselor of a camp in a YMCA, and they asked me to kosher a pot, which I had never done in my whole life. And I knew this halacha, and I put a brick in the oven, and I filled the pot with water, took the brick, put it in the pot, and about a gallon and a half of boiling water spilled all over the floor of the kitchen. So be very careful about how much water you're displacing and how big this object is, so it's not a problem. Sinks can be koshered if they're stainless steel or Corian. They have to be let to sit for 24 hours. Anything you're koshering through Hagalah needs to sit for 24 hours, so the taste that is absorbed in the item itself becomes pogum, becomes nullified in some way, and then it could be exposed to the process of Hagalah, which takes that taste and then nullifies it further through introducing the larger presence of water. So with your sink, you leave it for 24 hours, and then you pour boiling water all over the surface of the sink. Sometimes it takes a few pots to do that. And at the end of that, the sink is completely kosher. The sink is not a problem. With your counters, yeah, sorry?
Can you spend 1 second on the sink? You take the kettle off the fire.
Yeah.
Is there some window of time that considering the water not hot enough anymore?
As long as it's the temperature of resicha, as long as it's boiling. It doesn't have to be bubbling. As long as it's boiling. When you're koshering lots of things in that big pot, sometimes you have to wait a few minutes for it to boil up again. But if you're using, let's say, because again, kibolo kach polto, you know, that pot, even if it's off the fire for 2 seconds, is certainly hotter than most things that have hit that sink. And so therefore, that's not a problem. When you kosher the count, so counters depend on what type of substance the counters are made of. It's become increasingly popular to have granite counters and surfaces that can be koshered for Pesach. That doesn't mean it's wise to kosher them for Pesach, because it's very hard. I've been in people's homes when we've done this, and you cannot simply pour water on the counter and let the water just spread all over the counter, because by the time the water reaches other sections of the counter, it's no longer Irui Kli Rishon. It's already now been cooled off from the surface of the counter. And so therefore, you really need each point of the surface of the counter to be hit by the pouring of the boiling water. That is a lot of water, and it's difficult logistically to do. The way I've done it, the few times that I've done it, I never do it in my house, but the way I've done it when I've helped some people is we take two towels, and we sort of make lanes as we move the towels. So we take two towels, and there's a space in between, we pour the water. Then we move them over, we pour the water. Then we move them over, and we pour the water. The problem is that most kitchens that have these fancy new countertops also have beautiful cabinetry under these fancy countertops. And this puts water all over everything, and it's hot water, and it can tend to ruin things, and it's a difficult thing to do. So I don't recommend doing it, but not for kashrus reasons. You're welcome to do it, and it's perfectly kosher, and it's wonderful. And I'm happy to come to your house and eat off your counters and enjoy Pesach together with you. But at the end of the day, it is a very stressful and difficult thing to do. I personally find that it's easier to just cover them. We have granite countertops, and we just cover them. Sometimes I'll tell people, take one section, maybe the section right next to the stove, where it's really convenient to be able, because part of the granite is you don't have to put all the potholders down. So it's really convenient. So let that section, you know, so kosher that section. But I would advise to be careful. What about ovens? So self-cleaning ovens have the status of Liban Gomer. Liban Gomer means we're going to incinerate the blios, the absorbed taste. When you're incinerating the absorbed taste, so then you do not have to wait the 24 hours. The 24 hours are so that the taste could become pogum and then become batel in whatever it is we are doing, or the Liban Kal. But in the case where you have Liban Gomer, you're going to incinerate the blios, you don't have to wait 24 hours. This year, this is not going to be as much of an issue. Since Pesach's Friday night, we don't really have like a pressing Shabbos HaGadol issue with kashering the same way. But let's say you want to turn over on Motzei Shabbos, which some people do. So Motzei Shabbos, you're ready to turn over. And you want to make sure that your kitchen's ready to go. So if you're using Liban Kal, which I'll explain in a minute, but if you're using a self-clean oven, you don't have to worry. You don't even have to clean that oven. You can just wipe it down so that there's no, you know, gross dirt there, and then hit the self-clean and let it go. If it's not a self-clean oven, then it does need to be left for 24 hours. And then there's a machlokas, if it requires Liban Gomer or Liban Kal. Rav Moshe was of the opinion it required Liban Gomer, which meant that if you wanted to use that oven for Pesach, you either had to blowtorch the whole oven. No one here should ever use a blowtorch for anything. You don't have to do that. But that would be one way to accomplish Liban Gomer. The other way, which was very popular a long time ago, I don't think it's as popular now, though I'm sure some people still do it, is to have an oven insert. You have some sort of metal object that goes in the oven, and then you're not using the surface of the oven. That can change temperatures and baking patterns and cooking patterns and create lots of wonderful opportunities for shalom bayis. So I leave that in your hands if that's something you want to do. But we're here of the opinion that Liban Kal would suffice for even a non-self-cleaning oven. And what that means is that you should clean the oven very, very well. There needs to be really no substance in the oven that is chametz. That doesn't mean you have to clean the oven of all discoloration or all anything. It doesn't mean you have to do like a test with your finger and you don't feel anything. It means you've gone over the oven a few times. This is what I mean by not making yourself crazy. You splayed on the easy off. You went over the oven a couple of times. There's nothing there. There's a little bit of a burnt something. That's not chametz. That's not edible chametz. That's not making your Pesach kitchen treif. You know, but as long as there's nothing substantive there and you've cleaned it all out, you turn the oven up to the highest setting it could go to for 40 minutes, and that's it. You're good to go. Your oven is kosher. Your ranges, those can be koshered through Liban Gomer, because those are hit with fire themselves. And the way to do that is to take the ranges and turn the gas up on the highest setting and let it kosher the grates. What you generally tell people to do is you need to spread out the fire so it hits the whole grate. There are two ways to do that. One way is to use a blech. The other way is, if you don't have a blech, is to use a pot, but you must fill that pot with water, not for kashrus reasons, because if you don't, you could cause a fire, or the pot could break, or the pot could melt if you leave it too high. So you fill that pot with water. That does not need to be a kosher Pesach pot. But whatever you're putting on top of there, it spreads out the fire. Also, do not do all ranges at once. It does create too much heat. And if you have a plastic backing to your oven, it will melt. And I absolutely know people that have had major, major issues with their ovens because they were in a rush and they wanted to just get it all done. And they figured, you know, this is just the crazy rabbis that are reading all these articles and everything's going to be fine. And in the end, you know, there are real issues with their oven. So don't turn them all on at once. Do one, maybe two at a time, and that's it. The areas in between these ranges, you should cover with basically foil. And that's really done just because we don't want to put something hot down directly on it. Glass top ovens are much more complicated because we can't really kosher glass. And you can't really put something over it because it's going to... It could break the glass if you contain too much heat under those areas of the glass. You can kosher the area that becomes red hot. That's really fine. And there are different approaches to how to deal with that. Some people will put like potholder or cork kind of in between so that you just don't use the area in between and you just put pots directly on the area that can heat up to a glowing red. But there are different ways. There are different ways to deal with that. If that's part of your situation, there are the other thing that comes up often is so that's the stovetop. Warming drawers are not so easy to kosher because the heat setting doesn't really get high enough in order to kosher. But I did see a couple of years ago a suggestion made by the CRC. That if you purchase a sterno is that that little fire you see sometimes under the Chinese food or in other cities, fancier food, you know, that lights a fire. And if you light the sterno and you put it in and you assume that, you know, you leave it open a little bit for air or the sterno will go out and that will heat it up enough beyond what it usually has to be kosher. But I don't take any responsibility if that does in fact break the oven. The microwaves are a big discussion and they go back and forth. You know, if you can afford it and it's not a big deal and it's an investment for your Pesach, la'olam vaed, I'd be as gold tzedek, then, you know, just get a Pesach microwave. It's not the end of the world. They're pretty cheap. If you can't afford it, or you don't want it sitting around, or your microwave is built in, and you really need this microwave usable for Pesach. So generally what we do is clean the microwave out very, very well. You do need to replace that glass thing with something, with either a new glass thing, and that needs to be done in advance. Those aren't so easy to get, or sometimes you get a styrofoam replacement. And then you put basically a bowl of water inside. You heat up the bowl of water to the point that it boils and hits all of the different, we're assuming that the steam from the water is kibolo kach polto and pulling out from the rest of the glass. There are all sorts of different etzos. Heat a potato, feel the walls. If the walls are cold, that means the walls never get hot. If they never get hot, you don't even need to worry about the walls. And there are different approaches, but in general, you heat a bottle of water up very, very high, and if that's what you need to do for that, then it's fine. Towels and tablecloths, you just launder with soap. Water coolers, we just got a water cooler. The cold can be cleaned thoroughly and used for Pesach. The hot should not be used for Pesach. The assumption is that you put oatmeal under there or you put something chametzik on it, maybe a tradition soup or something, and you know it's possible that there was boleya and it's plastic, so we generally would not do that. So we just cover the hot side. If you know for sure that you never, ever, ever use the hot side for anything chametz, then you can use it. It's just... if it is used for things that are chametz, then it's something we would stay away from. The refrigerator, me'ikar adin, you could just clean the fridge. You do not have to line the fridge with plastic. That's always a big asek. A lot of people do because they just can't live with themselves with the fridge not lined with plastic. When you open our fridge, it mamish looks like something out of NASA. With the foil coming. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's like blinding. I have no idea why we do this. I'm sure we do it because in Europe they line the fridges with aluminum foil. I'm sure in Bavel they line the fridges with aluminum foil. So it's there. I'm told you should be careful to like poke holes in it because you need the the air going through the fridge in order for it to maintain its temperature. But my general approach is, you know, if you're the kind of person that's really mostly only putting cold things in your fridge, it's really not an issue. If you always, like, you take that piping hot soup on Friday night and you stick it on your, you know, even though I don't know what's hummus sticking that, you know, you take pizza right out of the oven, you stick it on the shelf of the fridge, you know, maybe a dorm fridge, you know, that may be, but probably the food in the dorm fridge is not Roy Lachila's Caleb, so it's not really a problem altogether. But if you want to spend a lot of time with your fridge, tovo alav bracha, and you should enjoy that. You know, I used to go through some of the products, but I have to tell you, all of this information is now very, very readily available online. The websites that I'm certainly comfortable with, although I'm sure there are many more, is the OU website, the CRC website, the Star-K website. Sometimes they disagree. Where they disagree, you're welcome to contact me, and I can help you choose the most lenient one. Or where they disagree, sometimes it's a real issue, and we have to clarify it. But the information is very readily available. I know at least two of them have apps. It used to be a big thing. I'd spend a lot of time leading up to Pesach getting texts from women at stores, very worked up, like they needed these questions answered right away. So Baruch Hashem, now you have the app, and you could be in the store, and you could find out from the phone exactly if what you're looking at is kosher l'Pesach, it's not kosher l'Pesach, whatever it is. All those things are available. Rabbi Eidlitz is excellent out of the West Coast. We should have mentioned him. That's right. A mechutin to Rabbi Yankelovich, which even gives it greater chashivos. Rabbi Yankelovich's daughter is married to Shui Eidlitz. Rabbi Eilitz out of the West Coast is great. There are lots of kashrus agencies that I would rely on. This is not, I don't want to get, you know, it's all good. But it's important to just check with everything. The other thing that does come up, it stopped being often coming up, but now with the health stuff, is quinoa. Quinoa, it's now assumed by most authorities to not be kitnios. You know, for a while, maybe it was kitnios, maybe it wasn't kitnios. It's actually a very interesting discussion, which maybe we'll have another time. What the general whole tone of the takona of kitnios is all about, and how quinoa would fit into that. But the general assumption is that quinoa is not a problem of kitnios. In the hotels, they use the quinoa to make sushi. That's what the rice is for sushi. It's quinoa, and then they put the seaweed in the thing in the middle. So I know you wanted to know that. So the thing you do have to worry about is they do say that the supply of quinoa does have issues in terms of grains getting in there and those kinds of things. So you do want to get a quinoa that does have a hashkacha for Pesach, not to just assume that because it's there, it's not an issue. The last thing I just wanted to mention, because for some reason this year it's coming up a lot, is the shiurim for Pesach Seder itself. So, you know, there are the general shiurim of matzah and dalikosas and those kinds of things. If there's a health issue, either a diabetic-related health issue, a general allergy-related health issue, so please contact me, because many of those shiurim have a tremendous amount of flexibility, you know, that could be evoked in order to deal with things. And I find generally we can work with the doctor to get ourselves to a place where we could at least be mekayim these mitzvos. But if there's a real health concern, a real health issue, then sometimes we have to deal with that. And then I wish you a Chag Kosher V'Sameach and a wonderful and inspirational Pesach. And next week we'll explore the Haggadah together. And Emir Tzashem, everyone should focus on the right things for our preparation. And any questions that you have, anytime, feel free to call me, to email me, to text me, to WhatsApp me, but I don't have notifications. So I don't always know that you're WhatsApping me. It requires me to exercise my Bechira to open the WhatsApp and to then see that actually happened, which I don't always do. I don't often do. For some reason, this is the limit to how much I can do. But in general, feel free to be in touch. I'm happy to help in any way I can. Wish all of you a Chag Kosher.
Thank you.